Organised violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo has long been associated with mineral wealth. The country is hugely rich in natural resources, indeed one of the wealthiest states in the world according to this metric. But today the DRC remains desperately poor. Without question, minerals are an important part of a political economy that has proven particularly vulnerable to exploitative tendencies in today's globalised world. Yet it is only one part of a broader, more complicated picture. We need to place it in context, exploring how the political economy of the DRC is changing and the potentials for the transition away from the logic of violence.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's army is pushing back rebels.
The word used to describe you is warlord, not peacemaker, warlord.
15 or more planes in and out every day, pillaging $2 million worth of loot every week from a jungle outpost that's been at the heart of this deadly conflict.
It's difficult to imagine. It's difficult to imagine the level of violence, the trauma, to see someone from your family being killed.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC, with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper. This is the second series of Conflict Zone, the podcast exploring the nature of organised violence in the 21st century. We take a look at the causes and drivers of intractable wars. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power driving organised violence in the modern world. This series is produced by the Conflict Research Programme based at LSC Ideas and funded by the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office.
In this podcast, we explore the economics of conflict in the DRC and how they are changing. Mineral extraction is a crucial cog in the global economy and one of its darkest corners, with major global financial interests very much embedded in the dynamics of conflict. But as international and local pressure to clamp down on rebel financing through minerals has gained momentum, armed groups are now turning to the use of checkpoints. In this new source of illicit finance, rents are extracted from the movement of people and goods across territories. While this could be seen simply as a problem for development efforts, the truth is more complex. The relationship between checkpoints and local governance reveals certain post-conflict potentials, modest but real opportunities to break with extractivist and violent logics through reform and transformation.
Part 1. The Global Economic System and the Mineral Wars in the DRC.
The DRC is today home to around 120 armed groups. They operate in local and regional pockets of the country's vast territory, sometimes described as approximating around two-thirds of the size of Western Europe. Indeed, the country's geography has long provided favourable terrain for guerrilla armies. Like many of the conflicts we analyse on the Conflict Research Programme, the creation of a social condition of violence in the DRC has its historical origins in the transition from the Cold War to the post-Cold War world. The country was one of many Western-sponsored dictatorships. They were backed on the basis they supported the fight against communism. Mobutu Sese Seko ruled as president from 1965 to his overthrow in 1997. The story of his rise to power reveals these linkages. A one-time army officer, Mobutu was close to the Belgian authorities, the former colonial power, and even allegedly worked for them as an informant. In 1960, Congo, along with many other African states, won its independence. Patrice Lumumba was the country's first democratically elected leader, but he broke a taboo in global diplomacy at the time. He called out the racism of colonial rule.
Fighters for independence, now victorious, I salute you on behalf of the Congolese government. We've had our share of insults and we have suffered blows morning, noon and night, simply for being Negroes.
Upon taking power, he was almost immediately overthrown and executed in 1961. The coup was backed by the United States and Belgium, as President Mobutu draped himself in African nationalism, renaming the country Zaire. He was a very corrupt dictator. Under his rule, the country's wealth was squandered. A 1982 IMF report put it starkly.
It is alarmingly clear that the corruptive system in Zaire, with all its wicked and ugly manifestations, its mismanagement and fraud, will destroy all endeavours.
But as an opponent of communism, Mobutu was assured of the backing of the West in the Cold War years. American President Ronald Reagan heaped praise on him from the White House steps in 1983, just a year after the IMF had levelled such serious accusations of corruption at his regime's economic record.
And I am pleased to have been able to meet again with President Mobutu, who's been a faithful friend of the United States for some 20 years.
The DRC was actually poorer in 1997, when Mobutu fell, than it had been at the time of its independence. GDP per capita stood at just $139, down from $220 in 1960. Infrastructure had also collapsed, as the quality of transport links across the country's huge territory was so poor, the state itself lost its coherence. Some have described it as morphing into a series of different sub-states as central authority broke down. Pierre Schouten is a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies. He argues the relationship between underdevelopment and extractivist industries runs deep in the history of the DRC.
I think it was in 1904 that a Belgian geologist started digging around in the soil of Katanga, one of the southern provinces of what is now the DRC and what was then Belgian Congo. And he called what he found a scandale géologique, a geological scandal, by which he meant that the subsoil of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Belgian Congo as it was called in the time, is home to an outrageous, bewildering variety of different kinds of minerals. I think it is the only country in the world where all the elements of the table of chemical elements are present in its subsoil. And that realization back then in Belgian Congo of that mineral wealth led to the setup of a colonial apparatus of control to take these wealthy minerals out of the ground, transport them along narrow channels out of the country and towards the industrial center of Belgium, which was a quite considerable industrial power at that time. And that apparatus of control in Belgian Congo, of course, also begot the subsumption of Congolese to the requirements of that extractive apparatus. And the lives of Congolese across the country became geared towards feeding the mining machinery in a very literal sense, because people in the farming areas had to contribute to feeding the workforces concentrated around these nodes of extraction at a regular pace. So the agricultural sector, infrastructure, everything was developed, control over populations in view of extracting that mineral wealth.
The trigger event for Mobutu's fall from power would come from without. The DRC became caught up in a true disaster for all of humanity, the 1994 genocide in neighbouring Rwanda.
I've seen some of the most terrible things today that I've ever seen. It's been absolutely horrific. The killings, the random killings, the soldiers going around and groups of youths armed with knives. I'm afraid I think that's still going on.
It is, I think, the standard against which all future tragedies will be measured.
The genocide carried out by Hutu extremists against Tutsis killed vast numbers of people, thought to be around 500 to 600,000. The backdrop was a civil war, which was catalysed further by the genocide. Forces of the Tutsi-backed Rwandan Patriotic Front retook the country. Hutu fighters, along with around a million Hutu civilians, fled into eastern DRC.
The people who killed my wife crossed the border 2 months later after me because they were chased now from the power. They lost the country. They had to be refugees in Congo.
The tragedy of this ethnic civil war led to a regional crisis. The First Congo War is sometimes referred to as Africa's First World War because of the sheer number of states and actors involved. Mobutu was removed, but the war also saw terrible atrocities committed against Hutu refugees and hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths. It triggered years of armed violence and conflict in the DRC, stretching all the way through to today. The DRC's extraordinary mineral wealth motivated many belligerents. The country is estimated to have something in the region of $24 trillion worth of mineral resources. Lise Koolen-Madayil is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Amsterdam.
The DRC is often cited to as the classic example of the resource curse, as a country that is enormously rich in natural resources, but does poorly in terms of economic and human development. And I don't think it is unsurprising that much of the armed activities that took place in the DRC in the last decades took place in the provinces that are the richest in terms of mining or oil assets.
The DRC is home, for example, to 60% of the world's cobalt, a crucial mineral used in electronic devices, from smartphones to car batteries. Pierre Schouten notes how the global demand for minerals led in the late 1990s and 2000s to the sector cutting deals with armed groups.
Congo became independent as one of the most infrastructure-rich countries and industrially developed countries in Africa, exactly because of the impetus to extract these minerals. Now, fast forward 40 years later, in the year 2000, the sale of PlayStations peaked around the world, and it appeared that to produce these PlayStations and other devices that were part of the kind of digital technology boom, it required minerals, which are exactly, again, in abundance under Congolese soils. And at the time, in Congo itself, there was a civil war ongoing, and mining entrepreneurs, mining dealers from the West started cutting deals directly with armed groups to access these minerals. So it's very true that at the heyday of the Congo Wars, as they are called, minerals played a really important role in financing conflict, but also, and I think this is perhaps more important, in associating what we do in the West, our consumption patterns, with conflict.
And although it's a hugely valuable commodity in international markets, this wealth does not trickle down to the base. Although industrial production exists in the DRC, in some areas mining resembles something akin to a cottage industry, an extremely labour-intensive exercise, with workers on desperately low subsistence incomes. These miners told the news network TRT the work has become more and more exploitative.
I can't support the family like I need to because it's $2 at the end of everything. That's only enough for food.
In the past, we used to work freely. You can dig your stones, buy them, or sell them to anyone you want. As long as you had the proper documents from the mining ministry, you are free working properly. There were no limits.
Pierre Schouten notes how the relationship between conflict and minerals has persisted to this day, but that extractivist logics can also take other forms.
Today still there's mining taking place in eastern Congo, artisanal mining, which involves armed groups profiting from that extraction and the transport of minerals out of Congo, on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's industrial mining concessions where often Western-owned companies use industrial machinery to extract minerals. And these processes depend on quite elaborate security apparatuses and the taking of land, which other people, local Congolese, consider their own. And so industrial mining involves a different kind of set of conflicts in the Eastern DRC.
The relationship between mineral wealth and organized violence in the DRC has led it to be favored a case study of the so-called resource curse theory. But this conception is problematic. The issues at play are multidimensional and complex. Importantly, the international community has often wrongly framed these issues as a DRC corruption problem alone, when, in fact, these practices are firmly embedded in global financial networks and associated international legal agreements. Lise Koolen-Madayil.
A lot of the focus of international law, so proper international law, the conventions and treaties that we have, is very much focused on corruption. So the act of distorting political bargaining processes through so-called quid pro quo arrangements, whereby companies secure material benefits in mining or oil assets by granting certain shares to politicians. While that political bargaining process, or while corruption in itself is certainly a crime that we should be paying attention to, I feel the focus on this political act has distracted from the larger economic impacts and the more systemic nature of what I refer to as grand theft taking place. So we focus on what is taking place in DRC, but we're not so much concerned with how the revenues generated in DRC are then distributed through the international economic system and financial system to different individuals and companies elsewhere, and how much of the financial loss in place actually lead to a situation where grand theft is more often legal than illegal.
A process of grand theft occurs when the financial and production network is skewed very strongly against local producers, in exchange for offering national elites rents. Global actors that control the distribution network to the point of sale can centralize and extract the bulk of revenue. This model is also highly flexible, capable of integrating cottage industry-style forms of work into a modern and globalized economics. Corruption plays a key role here, because relatively small amounts of cash can allow investors to purchase assets at a significantly reduced, below-market rate. But crucially, this is a global and systemic issue, not simply a local governance one.
When we talk about corruption, we are primarily concerned with the act that led to mining or oil assets being given to certain companies at an underpriced market value. But we are not so much focused with the profits that are generated afterwards. And we're not so much concerned with the myriad of financial institutions and companies headquartered in the United States and in Europe and, you know, elsewhere in the Western world that then benefit from the deal that was struck by illegal means. So we keep individualizing the crime of corruption, focusing on, you know, the participants of that initial deal. But there's not so much attention been given to what happens after a corrupt deal was struck.
By recognizing the systemic links at play, we can draw attention to the global economics and geopolitics driving these logics. China, for example, has become a major player in the DRC with significant resource rights and infrastructure investment. Meanwhile, alert to these challenges from the world's foremost rising power, in the United States there has been a drive to try and clean up its act in the country. The Trump administration is unlikely to go down in history as a champion of anti-corruption efforts. However, in 2017, Trump introduced Magnitsky sanctions on businessman Dan Gertler, a leading figure in the DRC trade.
Dan Gertler is also dubbed the gatekeeper to Congolese mineral wealth. He is a businessman who made his fortunes by befriending former Congolese president Joseph Kabila, who initially gave him the monopoly over Congolese diamond reserves. But eventually, Dan Gertler's activities extended to copper and cobalt mining, and lately he has also gotten involved in the Congolese oil sector.
Magnitsky sanctions are very serious. Effectively, they amount to a ban from the American economic orbit, an entire global network of financial and trade ties based on the dollar that extends far beyond the territory of the United States.
The Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act, and it permits the U.S. president to impose economic measures against individuals who have committed gross human rights violations or corrupt acts. And those measures include, for instance, seizing of property in U.S. territory, the banning of entry to the United States, and maybe most significantly, it prohibits U.S. companies and companies within U.S. jurisdiction from conducting business with sanctioned individuals. So effectively, it precludes anyone sanctioned under that regime to do any type of business activity in the U.S. currency, the dollar, which is the, you know, the dominant currency of global economic systems. The global Magnitsky sanctions therefore have a tremendous impact on sanctioned individuals and are therefore an incredibly effective tool to be used against profit-oriented crimes.
Dan Gertler, however, has continued to trade despite the sanctions. And the fact he was sanctioned by the Trump administration and was able to maintain operations in Europe should embarrass European states and the European Union.
The way he conducts his business is more or less as follows. So through his close friendship with Kabila, he can acquire oil and mining assets well below market value and then sells them at a huge profit to transnational companies. It is estimated that between 2010 and 2012, Congo lost $1.36 billion in mining revenues alone through such practices.
Pierre Shouten agrees that the case raises concerning issues for the EU and specifically the Dutch government.
Dan Gertler touches a personal snare for me because I'm Dutch, and actually his company, the Fleuret Group, is incorporated in the Netherlands. And I'm actually stunned that my own government, which is very neoliberal and very pragmatic when it comes to laundering money, is still, you know, not doing anything about the fact that one of the biggest criminals in relation to Congo is laundering his money through the Netherlands.
Indeed, this is not simply about a single individual, but rather the legal and economic conditions that make such activity possible. Only from this perspective can reforms be effectively pursued.
The Dan Gertler phenomena can only be explained by understanding the immense importance of transnational investment in industries that are heavily reliant on cost-intensive equipment to exploit natural resources. And it can also only be understood by factoring in the global oil and mining sector's structure. So really, a very few companies hold monopolies in exploiting such assets. Dan Gertler, therefore, through both his excellent relationships to the Congolese elite and his network within the oil and mining industry, was able to position himself really as the central focal point of mining or oil asset deals being struck in the territory of the DRC.
So this underlines the need for international cooperation geared towards structural and legal reform of the global system, including improving European efforts in line with its commitments under the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention. Since the change in American administration, there is a new impetus for cooperation in the OECD, and this provides an opportunity to bring about long-needed structural changes in trade and finance.
Part 2. From the mineral to the checkpoint economy.
Important as the mineral wars are, conflict resolution attempts that focus only on the problems of extractivist global supply chains will miss other vital elements of change and evolution taking place inside the DRC. Indeed, Pierre Shouten argues that we should not telescope the causes and logics of conflict.
There's a clear linkage between mineral extraction and conflict in Eastern Congo, has been historically always. But is that the only source of conflict financing? Is it the only driving force behind the conflicts? And there it's important to point out that conflict keeps on raging on in these parts of Eastern Congo where there's no minerals at all available, and where struggles seem to involve different set of stakes and different financing mechanisms which elude a reduction of the conflict to simply a matter of greed around the extraction of subsoil wealth.
Efforts by international actors to move away from the mineral economy are now taking place.
There's been a wide array of efforts that have been launched in the past years, hailing from the US, hailing from the OECD, corporate initiatives themselves, to disassociate the way that we consume digital devices with and produce them with the conflict that goes on in the Eastern DRC. And companies in the US have been required through the so-called Dodd-Frank Act to actually report on whether the minerals that they use, so-called conflict minerals, because those are minerals which are mined in Congo, whether these minerals are in fact from Congo and whether they might be involving the financing of armed groups. Yet, and I think this is a quite interesting point, each year when these self-reporting efforts by companies are taken under scrutiny by the Government Accountability Office, they find that, and I almost quote literally, 90% of the companies involved could not confirm or disconfirm whether these minerals come from Congo. So I think a lot of these efforts are important. It's important that there is a lively global debate around the role of minerals and the financing of conflict in Congo, whether minerals contribute to development or underdevelopment in Congo. But by granting a rather big role to companies and self-reporting by companies who are involved in the extraction of these minerals or in profiting from their transformation, you create a setting where it becomes very likely that some of these efforts actually help a kind of blue washing or whitewashing or greenwashing, if you will, of the way that these minerals travel outside of Congo.
Nonetheless, these actions are changing some of the calculations for the financing of rebel groups, but still we find important links to the global economy.
So the checkpoint economy is a term which I've coined to point to the widespread presence, the actually endemic presence of checkpoints or roadblocks, if you will, in Eastern Congo. I started out in 2013 researching how the global beer company Heineken was entangled with conflict actors in Eastern Congo. And I found out that at the time, this global beer brand had been, perhaps unbeknownst to its corporate HQ, contributing to the financing of an armed group called M23. Because the transporters that Heineken uses to bring beer, crates of beer, to the most remote locales in Eastern Congo had to pass through the checkpoints of this armed group M23 and pay to pass. And in fact, it appeared that M23 did not at all rely on the direct control over mining sites or access roads to mines per se, but focused its efforts on strategic nodes in the road network of Eastern Congo, where they could simply tax anything that passed. And it was estimated at the time by the UN group of experts on the conflict in Congo that M23 might make about $200,000 from taxation at such checkpoints alone each month.
Recognition of the role played by the checkpoint economy has changed the prevalent understanding of the DRC as conflicts fueled by minerals alone.
I was also imbued with this idea that conflict minerals were at the core of what drove conflict, or at least its financing in Eastern Congo. And then I found that one armed group was entangled with a global beer company through checkpoints. So I asked myself, what if this is just one company and one armed group, what if we look at all the checkpoints and all global actors and how they interrelate perhaps in Eastern Congo? It took a while, but I ended up mapping over 800 roadblocks in Eastern Congo in just two provinces. And we mapped 800 not because there wasn't more, but simply because we ran out of money to further map more checkpoints. And it appeared that actors of all stripes, any kind of rebel group you want, but also actors associated to the state, soldiers, state authorities, civil actors, traditional customary chiefs, they all rely in a kind of relatively decentralized fashion on simply setting up shop along roads and waiting for people to pass and then taxing them. I don't think the checkpoint economy is displacing the conflict economy, conflict minerals, but I do think that minerals are just one supply chain passing through checkpoints, and that there's a lot of scrutiny for this one kind of supply chain of minerals, the flow of minerals, but other kinds of flows are just as much subject to taxation by rebels and state forces at the checkpoints as minerals are.
Piers Houghton gives the example of a case he came across in the conflict-ridden North Kivu province. General Mando, the leader of the Mai Mai Simba, the oldest rebel movement in Congo, had been extracting a lucrative income from the mining trade. But the mine was seeking a green certification in the international cleaning up effort.
So now government actors arrived, the government army, the local administrator, a swath of civil representatives and authorities, and they come to negotiate with him to please go away from the mine because the mine is slated to be certified green under a traceability scheme exactly of the global supply chain of minerals. And what it turns out is that Mando is not willing to completely give up control over that mining site because it is so profitable. And the civil authorities actually proposed to him to simply set up shop at a certain distance from the mine and simply tax people on their way. In that way, the civil authorities could claim that the mine is conflict-free because, yes, there's no armed group physically present on the mine, and thus have the mine certified as a green and legit mine, which means that they can also tax its proceeds, while at the same time accommodating Mando by letting him tax the activities and the kind of cash generated by that process of mining from a distance.
This illustrates the danger of simplistic remedies to complex problems, which involve global and local dynamics.
This is for me an anecdote which I think epitomizes the creativity of people in Eastern Congo and the naivete perhaps of efforts to address the financing of conflict through very simple causal mechanisms to say, well, if we can clear mining sites of conflict actors, that means that in that particular instance, there is no more conflict minerals and the minerals do not contribute to conflict any longer. So as Western actors, we can feel fine consuming these minerals out of Congo and we're contributing hence to development. That assumes that simple narrative that conflict actors are stupid and that people like General Mando, faced with being expelled from a mining site, will not find and devise other strategies to work around these limitations all over Congo, really, and with any initiative to address conflict financing, you see that rebels aren't stupid, that they find ways around them, very creative ways.
And this is why a multidimensional approach is needed. It should start with the recognition that efforts on the ground to reform local governance have to be undertaken in tandem with international policy change. Checkpoints are also playing an important role in local governance more broadly. Godfroid Mazilia Kehingu is professor at the Department of History and Social Science at the Higher Education Institute of Bukavu. He argues that to understand the role that checkpoints are playing in contemporary DRC, it is necessary to distinguish between state and non-state actors.
Pour comprendre comment les barrières routières font partie de la vie dans l'est de la RDC.
To understand how road checkpoints form part of life in Eastern DRC, we need to categorize them. There are two types. There are state ones and non-state ones. State checkpoints are themselves diverse. There are police road traffic ones. There are checkpoints that go up at nighttime in particular parts of town. There are also two sporadic points for the recovery of tax and duties due to the Congolese state.
Il y a aussi des points sporadiques de recouvrement de taxes et impôts dus à l'État congolais.
Checkpoints run by non-state actors may bring to mind violence and confrontational scenes, but research undertaken by the Conflict Research Programme has brought to light the diverse role played by these bodies.
Par rapport aux barrières non étatiques, on trouve qu'il y a des associations de conducteurs.
In relation to non-state checkpoints, we find associations of drivers who also manage to recover, I don't know if we can call them taxes, but they manage to recover the taxes to their associations. We call them the parking barriers, because before leaving a parking lot, you have to pay a sum of money to people called inspectors. Inspectors, of course, of these particular associations. They oblige each vehicle to pay, and those who don't are supposed to not leave the parking lot. Also among non-state barriers are those called the RASTA. The RASTA checkpoints are run by the young and unemployed who pretend to be engaged in development work, like roadworks, and oblige each vehicle, rather than each individual, to pay these groups who say they are engaged in communal work.
In some cases, they are closer to what we might call a form of antisocial behaviour, but in a form that provides an irregular and precarious form of employment.
Checkpoints are seen as spaces not only of harassment, but also employment, in two particular ways. For the agents working them, they are spaces of employment, as everyone who goes through has to pay something. With this, they can provide for their families. And then around them is the development of small shops and businesses. Bars open, restaurants, small food markets. It creates a chain of employment in terms of those who run the checkpoint and those who live around it. These service the people and vehicles who are stopped, who can even make use of them to refresh themselves with the little things sold in the community around the checkpoint.
Profitent pour se ravitailler en de petites choses qui sont vendues dans cette communauté autour de laquelle les barrières sont érigées.
So, despite the undoubted problems checkpoints create for some, this picture adds nuance and helps us to desensationalize the checkpoint economy. It's important to recognize their role as centers of community activity, where beverage and food stalls form, perhaps even creating the basis for what we might call on the conflict research program civicness, the kind of stable civic relations needed to move beyond the logics of conflict and violence. This nuanced perspective is shared by other scholars on the ground in the DRC. Bienvenu Mukangilwa is a research assistant with the CER UKI at the Higher Education Institute of Bukavu.
Le barrage routier font partie de la vie à l'est de la République démocratique du Congo.
Checkpoints are part of life in the east of DRC. They are omnipresent because we find them almost everywhere, both in urban and rural areas. They are part of the local landscape, and this for a few decades now. We also refer to their number, which has substantially increased since the First Congo War, i.e. 1996. Some of them are circumstantial and sporadic, as, for example, those who erected at night by the National Army in order to prevent the attacks of bandits and roadblockers who sowed terror on the roads of the region.
DRC citizens have different perspectives on checkpoints depending to some degree on their social position and relationship to the community. For road users, they are a hindrance and form of de facto direct taxation. For some local communities, they can be an important source of revenue and economic activity. However, even here the situation is complicated. The resources from checkpoints are not equitably shared.
Some might be happy, but they only represent a very small section of the population. As such, some people, including some local chiefs, estimate that the resources generated by the checkpoints are not shared with the local communities. For example, roads are often still in a terrible state, despite the pretext that the money gathered would serve for their maintenance. And it is rare that those running the checkpoints issue from the communities affected by them. So many checkpoints have no legitimacy among local populations. The rare checkpoints that are encouraged, and even then more by road users than by local populations, are those maintained by the army situated in areas considered dangerous because of recurrent attacks by armed bandits. They are considered beneficial to security, even though they also require payment of crossing fees.
Nonetheless, there are interesting examples of checkpoints facilitating post-conflict recovery.
A first example is situated in Makobola, a village sadly famous for a massacre perpetrated there in December 1998, which led to the population fleeing to other towns. Only a few people stayed. With the erection of the checkpoint in 2006, it rapidly became the center of economic activities in the village. The market, the little shops, the little bar and other entertainments, such as the cinema, were organized. And it was a chance, too, to have clients amongst the road users forced to stop there. There are also the agents running the checkpoint who rent houses in the village and establish friendships with local people. For example, after dark, under solar-powered lights, people gather to chat, to pass the time, to share a drink. So local inhabitants recognize that the checkpoint does play a role in the maintenance of life in the village.
Peer argues on similar lines that we should avoid the register of good or bad in relation to checkpoints and recognize the complexity, especially in the context of extractivist exploitation.
If you take a deeper perspective, you could say people who live in a place have always, in a deep historical time, asked passing strangers to pay for passing safely. It's about the oldest practice you can find of proto-state formation, I would say. And in many places around the world, it makes a lot of sense for locals to say, well, hey, if you pass through here with wealth, possibly extracted from our land, we will raise a checkpoint to make sure that you invest in the local economy, to put it between brackets. And I think it's really important to remain sensitive to that kind of perspective on what roadblocks mean. Are they just a mechanism of predation on locals? Or are they a way for locals to ensure that they derive some form of benefit from the circulation of people, wealth, which otherwise would perhaps be unchecked?
The checkpoint economy cannot be separated from the history of conflict, nor the role played by minerals as a driver of conflict, but it provides a more nuanced way to understand this history and dynamics, as Bjorn Venue argues.
The presence of checkpoints is tied to the security and economic context of the region, a context defined by years of war and violence, as well as trafficking of natural resources, of which minerals is the largest item. So checkpoints are used both as a point of control, but also taxation, and therefore for the gathering of revenue.
For Peer, a first step for the international community lies in simply recognizing the role of global economic actors in contributing to rebel finance. Awareness is the key basis for any further reform.
For me, the pivotal thing is not getting rid of the checkpoints. I think one could raise questions around, are we happy to know that Western actors are contributing quite substantive amounts to the financing of armed groups in Congo and elsewhere? And how come we don't know much about this? Because war zones and conflict zones are cross-cut by supply chains of aid, minerals, tropical hardwood, commercial goods. And these are, you know, supply chains overseen by global companies, but most of them pay at checkpoints of rebels or people with army uniforms. But hey, is this the kind of people you want to pay? How is it possible that this is invisible, right? And I think we should investigate the way that global supply chains are structured in such a way to render these kind of payments and processes and complicities invisible.
In this global political and economic context, seeking better regulation of checkpoint activity, which attempts to improve civic relations and establish social norms around their operation, may be the best available option for policymakers.
Okay, now, what if you render these processes accountable and that you make it insightful that global companies might be contributing to that, and you would restructure that process in a way that they would stop paying rebel groups in places like Eastern Congo. Then you derive these rebel groups from a source of income which derives from taxing foreigners. And you might compel them to start taxing locals instead. So from a kind of ideological standpoint, I much prefer a situation in which Congolese rebels and people with army uniforms on tax wealthy expatriates instead of having to rely on poor farmers to extract the wealth that they seem to be after. So there's a question, is it a good idea to stop checkpoints from taxing global supply chains, or is it a way to offer a predictable funding, a predictable way of keeping rebels financed without them having to rely on kidnapping, harassing locals, etc., etc.?
In short, when it comes to reform, there is a high possibility of unintended consequences, taking measures to clean up global economic links, which inadvertently lead to rebel groups targeting local populations for rents. And this therefore underlines the need for a multidimensional approach, which links together issues of global financial reform, local governance, and the need for redistributive economic development.
Conclusion: linking the local and global to move beyond the logics of violence.
The relationship between the political economy of conflict and the importance of local governance we have discussed in this podcast brings together issues of key concern to the conflict research programme. They underline the importance of the global financial and economic system and its role as a factor in conflict. This connects with local settings to drive logics that the programme refers to as the political marketplace, when politics becomes an issue of buying and selling support, often connecting with exclusionary identity politics. Overcoming these logics requires, on the one hand, a different form of political authority, which is seeking stable civic relations, what we have called civicness. This emphasises the importance of creating local governance structures that have legitimacy, and, on the other hand, these local efforts also need to be supported at the global level, particularly in terms of the issues we have discussed in this episode, tackling illicit money, corruption, and criminality. In short, a local and global approach is needed.
That concludes this podcast in what is the final episode in the second series of Conflict Zone. We hope you found the series informative and educational. Conflict Zone is produced by the Conflict Research Programme at LSE Ideas, LSE's in-house foreign policy think tank. The podcast is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at our website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. The site has details of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all of our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter @LSE_CRP and @LSE Ideas.